Bankless Nation, welcome to the weekly roll-up. Today on the episode, we got Haseeb Qureshi as my co-host for this episode. Haseeb, how are you doing, my man? Good to see you.
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
Really good. Really, really good. There's always just a mountain of news to go through, and I'm really happy to have you here, my man. Let's talk about what we're going to talk about this week. Trump Watch. Trump signed a crypto executive order called Strengthening American Leadership in Digital Financial Technology, which included a bunch of things, including a working group for a national crypto stockpile. Hester Peirce and the SEC revoked SAB 121, and which gives, of course, the green light to banks to custody crypto. This open source AI platform, Venice, launched its token and made a huge number of people very happy this week, but also some drama around the Coinbase listing. Abstract Chain went live with their mainnet, and Gary Gensler gets a new job. Haseeb, before we get into any of this news in specific, how would you give this week a vibe? What was the vibe of this week, just in a sentence?
Chaotic. I think it's been a chaotic. Very chaotic week. Yeah. It's one of these weeks where the outside world is really shaking what's going on in crypto. So you're feeling like you're inside the snow globe and seeing all the stuff getting floated up. That was the vibe this week.
Is that a combination because of NVIDIA and then also politics?
Yes. I feel like that's going to be the theme of the year, is that a lot of stuff that's not related to crypto is going to be shaking up the crypto world.
Well, both NVIDIA and politics are top of this agenda, so let's go ahead and get right into it. But before we do, a moment to talk about our friends and sponsors over at the Crypto Tax Calculator. It's tax season. We know that's a lot of stressful time for everyone in the Bankless community and probably you, listener, as well. But that's why we like the Crypto Tax Calculator, because it takes away a lot of stress out of taxes. I have an accountant that I just pay, so I don't have to think about this, but they use Crypto Tax Calculator. And so if you just want to reduce your suffering this tax season, you can use Bankless 15 to get 15% off. Or if you're a Bankless citizen, there is a link inside the Discord to get 30% off. You can go into the show notes and find those codes and those links. All right, Haseeb, let's get into markets. Let's start with NVIDIA. The big headline that I think rocketed around the world is NVIDIA sheds almost $600 billion in market cap, biggest one-day loss in U.S. history. That's 17% off of NVIDIA. This was on the backs of this Chinese AI lab, DeepSeek, that unveiled this new open source model that it claimed only took 2 months and less than $6 million to build. People are going back and forth on the validity of that claim. But what is basically well understood is that the performance of this new ChatGPT competitor is extremely strong and extremely real. DeepSeek got to the first place of the Apple Store charts in just a few days, which is pretty crazy. It is currently number one at the time of recording. And then David Sacks, of course, who is the crypto AI czar, says DeepSeek R1 shows that the AI race will be very competitive. I'm confident in the U.S., but we cannot be complacent. Haseeb, when you saw this news come across your desk, how did you interpret it? What was your reaction?
Honestly, one of my first reactions was, so I saw the DeepSeek R1 paper when it originally came out 7 days ago, 8 days ago now. Mm-hmm. So I saw Wall Street had a very delayed reaction to this announcement. Mm-hmm. So nothing actually really changed between when the paper was actually released. Even the numbers, so people were talking about the $6 million model to train. That was actually a predecessor to R1 called, their V3 model. And that was released in December. Hmm. So it's one of these things where you realize markets are just not efficient. Like, it just took Wall Street people over the weekend to actually understand what the fuck just happened, like what actually hit them. And I think the biggest thing is that there's so much misinformation that's out there now about DeepSeek, mm-hmm. of people who just do not understand what it means to have, first of all, how AI labs work and like how much CapEx goes into actually building an AI lab. People are really fixating on this idea that it took $6 million to train. It took $6 million to train the final iteration of the model in GPU hours. Yeah. But how much did it cost to acquire all the GPUs? Right. How much did it cost to pay all the salaries? How much did it cost to do all the other training runs that failed? The reality is that
$6 million is built on top of a mountain of cash.
Almost certainly they spent over $100 million on all this stuff end to end. Now, to be clear, that's way less than OpenAI spending, way less than Meta spending. That's very significant because it means that AI is a lot cheaper than we thought it was going to be. That's good. To be clear, that's good for you and me. That's good for almost
consumers
everybody.
Consumers of AI products should be thrilled.
Exactly. It's bad for producers.
Yeah.
The NASDAQ is overwhelmingly weighted towards producers because, you know, NVIDIA is one of the biggest companies in the world now. And yeah, it's really bad for NVIDIA because in the same way, you know, when oil prices come down, it's bad for Exxon. Mm-hmm. But it's good for us. It's good for everybody else.
It's good for
everyone
the world.
Who drives. Yeah. So I think, by and large, this DeepSeek thing is actually great for all of us, But the reality is that the balance sheets of the Fortune 500, the balance sheets of the NASDAQ, do not contain people spending money on AI.
Right.
Because it just hasn't shown up yet as a line item on most people's balance sheets. It's only a cost right now. Mm-hmm. No one's making money on AI yet. Everyone's paying money to create AIs. But I think in the long run, this is only a good thing. I mean, this thing is open source. It's literally more open source than Meta is. Like, they release all the intermediate models, not just the final model that they release like they did for Llama. So DeepSeek, I think, is an unalloyed good for the world. Super, super awesome. Super bullish for AI generally. Super great for the consumer. But just like with anything, you have to overlay it with geopolitics and fear and FOMO and all this stuff. So I think markets really got this one wrong in having a generally bearish sentiment on the entire market and on risk assets. Huge mistake. Definitely right that NVIDIA's stock should go down, but right. Absolutely wrong that anything else should make you less bullish on where this technology is going.
Yeah, notably, a number of crypto AI projects have already integrated the R1, the DeepSeek R1 model. Venice now has DeepSeek R1 in its product. And I'm happy that we are seeing the creations of these AI labs, which are very expensive, very hard to produce, as you said, tons of CapEx. You know, maybe it costs $6 million to train, but again, like you said, that's built on top of the shoulders of OpenAI and many other people, hundreds of millions of dollars to get to that last $6 million mile. And then it's open source. And so while OpenAI is truly closed, and so is Meta and Claude and all these other, you know, LLMs, we have this arms race going on between China and the United States. But then if it continually ends up in the hands of the open source community, just, you know, 3, 6, 9 months later, and we get all these things for free because of this arms race competition, I'm pretty happy with the way that totally. Kind of unfolds.
I mean, it's deflationary. It's deflationary super in the purest sense of the word. And as a consumer, you could not want anything more from technology than to deflate the price of goods. If you remember back early in the AI arms race, there was a leak. There was like an internal document at Google that got leaked that basically said there's no moat in AI and right. that it doesn't, like, open source is so good and it's getting so much better so quickly that even though the frontier labs are always 2 to 3 months ahead on the state of the art, open source catches up really fucking fast. Mm-hmm. And we have just seen that with R1. R1 is as good as O1. Literally, okay, so O3 is supposed to be the new OpenAI model, which is definitely better than R1. But R1 is basically 1/20th of the cost of O1, and it's getting the same performance. That's crazy. That's incredible. And that's awesome for everybody involved. What it tells you is that, so one thing, it means that the moats that these AI companies are supposed to have are not what we previously imagined. And also means the moat for NVIDIA is probably not what we previously imagined. But what it is very good for decentralized AI. It's very good for open source, very good for homebrew. And this is the moat this is the part of the pool that we play in. You know, on the crypto side, we are all about the democratization of technology and what that can happen when that goes in the hands of individual users and entrepreneurs. A world where OpenAI owns all the intelligence or Google owns all the intelligence is a world that sucks for us. There's nothing for us to do because we've got all the crappy models, you know, sitting here in the reject pile. That's not the world we're living in right now. So that is something I'm, as an investor and as a crypto person, very, very excited about.
Haseeb, you said this is something that the markets got wrong with the response to the NVIDIA price tanking 17% on the back of DeepSeek. We did a podcast with this individual, Jeffrey Emanuel, who wrote this short case for NVIDIA stock. He released this on Friday. When we did the podcast with him, he talked about how this article, which it's a 60-minute read, it's very dense, it's very technical. This guy clearly knows his stuff. He was telling me about the Google Analytics for this article, where it started off just, you know, 50, 100 people reading it as soon as he published it. But over the weekend, it just ballooned to 2.5 million views, starting in the New York, Manhattan area, and then quickly moving to Silicon Valley. And I can't remember the name of the town that NVIDIA is in, but also a lot of right where NVIDIA headquarters are. And so he is actually taking the credit for the market movement because it happened. He wrote it on Friday and the market processed it over the weekend and then
it
dumped on Monday.
I think it's correct, by
the
way.
You think he actually did that?
I saw this over the weekend. I think it was probably the spark that started it.
Yes.
I don't know that it wouldn't have happened anyway at some point when Wall Street finally ingested what this meant. Mm-hmm. Because clearly it has implications for NVIDIA, right?
Right.
If the AI movement is all happening within the US, then NVIDIA is good. NVIDIA is in great shape. If people are not open sourcing top tier models that are more efficient than OpenAI models, then okay, that's great for NVIDIA. NVIDIA wants everything to be closed and wants everything to be sold to commercial enterprises that are going to be charging huge markups on their models. this is not the world that we're living in now. And Wall Street would have eventually figured that out. I think that being said, I agree that NVIDIA's stock should have gotten hurt. Mm. And obviously it did, right? But also the market realized that it overreacted. So it went down 70% on Monday, and then it went back up 9% the next day, which was not only the biggest single market cap loss for any company ever in a single day, but then it was one of the biggest market cap gains for a company in any given day because it just rebounded so much the next day. Now, it's still down from the high quite a bit, but I think the lesson of the story is that it dragged down a lot of other stuff with it, which mm-hmm. is what I think was incorrect, right? Taking what the prospects for NVIDIA and basically their moat in hardware and saying, okay, this should affect how you think generally about risk assets, that is what I think is a mistake. Because I think it's actually good for all of the risk assets that AI is cheap. I think it's great for all of us. We actually don't want a world where AI is expensive.
Right. Totally. All right, let's get into the crypto native markets. Let's talk about Bitcoin. Bitcoin started the week at $101,000.5, and then it's up 3% on the week to where it is now at $105,000. Ether, not doing as great, started the week at $3,200, ending the week at $3,250. And then, of course, I think something to pay attention to is the Bitcoin-Ether ratio. I don't know how closely you pay attention to the ratio, Hasib, but it did very briefly go below the 0.03 number. It is at above the 0.03 right now, almost at 0.031, but it did hit 0.02999, which is where Udi Wertheimer and the famous breaking ETH BTC breaking down below a 0.03 watch party. That was that famous level. Give me your sense of the crypto markets right now. Bitcoin's still pretty high. Ether doing the same thing it's been doing for 2 years. Just give me your sense on the markets, Hasib.
Yeah, I mean, there was a big sell-off triggered by the DeepSeek fears over the weekend, and it doesn't feel like alts have really recovered. It seems like mostly everything's just been bleeding for the last month. So the only thing that really has had any kind of signs of life are Solana. Even Solana is way off the high. So it hit the 280s right after Trump token launch, Trump and Melania. And since then, it's just been, you know, it's done the best of all alts, but most alts across the board have just bled and haven't really seemed to be able to find their footing with respect to what there is to look forward to in this market.
Did you see this tweet from Ben Cowan? I thought this was super interesting. He goes, the reason why the vibe is so off despite $100,000 Bitcoin is because the advanced decline index, ADI, of the top 100 cryptocurrencies has been in a downtrend since 2021. Now, the advanced decline index, that's not really a metric I see cited too often, but I think the general vibe is of the top 100 coins, most of them are in just a downtrend for the last 2 years. And so there are some that exceptions, like you said, Solana, Dogecoin is an exception, Ripple is an exception, Bitcoin is an exception. But other than that, everything is mostly on a pretty solid downtrend for the past 2 years. And that's why Ben Cowan is citing the vibe just feels off. Vibes feel bad. So I'm calling this the middle of the market, which is, you know, these are startups. These are startups that you and I invest in. This is people's jobs. This is, you know, the BD in the industry. And so the middle of the market has not really felt the same price appreciation that some of the outliers have, like Bitcoin, Solana, all these other ones. What's your take on this?
Yeah, there is definitely a bit of a vibe session going on right now where, like, look, if you look in absolute terms, right, the biggest crypto assets, which are Ethereum, obviously not Ethereum, Ethereum has been bleeding, but if you look at Bitcoin, Ripple, Solana, BNB, those are actually doing fairly well. Mm-hmm. And then the big middle of the market is just really hurting.
Yeah.
And a lot of things are down even from March last year, which is a little bit crazy, right? That was when the ETF launched and we were like, oh, well, maybe that's going to get us to this great bright future. You know, a lot of things haven't hit their high even after Trump got elected. They didn't hit the high from March last year. So it does feel like, okay, it's more than just macro. There's a general lack of enthusiasm about what's going on in kind of tech crypto outside of Solana. And I think that's likely to continue for a while until there is some real energy around it. The reality is that, you know, Bitcoin and the meme coin complex are really taking up most of the energy, which is one, you know, Bitcoin is this big macro political story. And then meme coins, I mean, now it's become a political story, but before that, it was just kind of this, you know, frenetic, up and down, you know, kind of retail consumer frenzy. And besides that, nobody really wants to hear about
crypto.
You know, what's going on the technology side. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, when's the last time you heard anyone get excited about ZK or anybody get excited about, you know, privacy coins or anything like that?
I think people are just tired about promises. Like, crypto loves to write promises. And we don't really fulfill promises too much. And I think people like crypto outsiders and even crypto insiders are just kind of fatigued about all the promises that we write.
I think that's right. I think there's also an element of, it's not that I think, you know, when I look at all these founders, they did build the thing, but they didn't get everybody in the world to use the thing. And that's one of the virtues, of course, of Solana, is that they've been so focused on just getting users on the chain and getting adoption and getting into people's hands. And very few entrepreneurs are actually well equipped to be able to do that. A lot of them don't really have the distribution advantage that a Binance or, you know, some of these big exchanges that really know how to get things in the hands of consumers have. So you've got, you know, the Bases of the world, you've got the Solanas of the world that really have that direct relationship with consumers and can tell that bigger story about, hey, here's why this thing is going to go in your pocket and become a part of your financial life. Most people don't have that ability. And so I think you're seeing this kind of, this difficulty of entrepreneurs who really have, some of them really have the goods, but they're just not able to really reach people's wallets. And I think that does wax and wane over the course of a cycle, just because people are more interested in trying new things and people care more about some of these technology stories that are undergirding this all this stuff. But I agree with you. Most people feel like, hey, I haven't seen anything. All I see is, tokens go up. So, all right, I'll play tokens go up.
Right. I'll play the token go up game. Despite the bad vibes, you're at $3.7 trillion in total market cap for the industry. I think that's just one, maybe $200 billion off of the all-time high. So we are nearing the market cap all-time high. I mean, that's definitely helped by the fact that Bitcoin is also at all-time highs. And then also Ripple is just $80 billion from flipping Ethereum. I'm keeping an eye on that. We're going to skip. Sorry?
NFTV, not a
NFTV. NFTV, yes, NFTV. Yeah, very different number on the Ripple side. We're going to skip the Bitcoin and Ether ETFs this week because not too much action happened there. But nonetheless, there was some action in the ETF land. Bitwise filed for a Dogecoin ETF, which I always thought that this made sense as the third possible ETF to come into the fray. I know a lot of people want the Solana ETF, and I'm sure we will eventually get one, but Dogecoin just has the Lindy. It's been around for forever. And then we also, on the backs of that, saw Tuttle Capital filed for 10 different leveraged crypto asset ETFs. So a 2x long XRP, 2x long Solana, 2x long Trump coin, 2x long Melania coin ETFs. These are all ETFs, Cardano, Chainlink, Polkadot, Bonk. So, I mean, I agree with the Dogecoin ETF. That one makes sense. And then we see a splattering of some leveraged long meme coin ETFs. So a tale of two very different stories here. Haseeb, give me your takes on the ETF side of the story.
I don't know that I have that much of a take. Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Okay, what do you think about the Dogecoin ETF, though? Does Dogecoin deserve an ETF? Look,
it makes sense. I think Dogecoin is liquid enough, global enough that, yeah, why not put an ETF around it? I think on some level, the SEC just doesn't want to. I don't know that it's like, oh, well, this is a non-registered security. I think it's just that, please don't make me do this. I think at some point, because that's the thing, is that once you list Dogecoin, how are you not going to list everything? You know, how are you going to say no to all the other meme coins? So I think there's some just kind of dragging their feet, most likely, when it comes to Doge. I think Solana, there's probably more appetite of like, oh, hey, there's a real thing. I can see why it's important to give retail investors access to this in a ready vehicle. But I would kind of suspect before we get a Doge ETF and before we get a Solana ETF, I'd expect we'd probably see a MicroStrategy for Doge or a MicroStrategy for Solana. Mm. Like, I actually think if those were to, you know, some kind of zombie in the NASDAQ decides, you know what, we're just going to buy a bunch of, we're just going to issue debt and we're going to use it to go buy some Doge. I think it would actually be super well received. And that would be the first way that you could go into a brokerage account and get exposure to Doge, get exposure to Solana. And I expect that's probably the order of operations, is that probably happens first before we actually get the ETFs.
Why haven't we seen that? I have heard discussions of, I'm building the MicroStrategy for Ethereum, or this is the MicroStrategy for Solana. Why haven't we seen anything like that?
Well, so one, there's not a lot of Michael Saylor type people out there.
A crazy leader.
You kind of need to be chest thumpy. You got to know how to hype people up in Wall Street. It's a different skill than hyping people up in crypto.
Right.
So there is actually this thing in Canada that's like a Solana MicroStrategy.
Yes, I was looking at it yesterday. It's like Sol CF. But they do they do a bunch of diversified investments in cannabis and like other.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, okay,
I don't know
and
that much about it.
So like I thought I was looking at this last night. Funny you bring this up. And like I'm of the mind that if they pivoted 100% to Solana and they sold all of their other stuff and they just only were a concentrated Solana bet, then I'm interested.
Right.
It's currently at $50 million
trading at a big premium to NAV. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, it's a huge premium to NAV, which is kind of like okay at this point. How much more of a premium of NAV do you expect it to have when it goes full Solana? You know, it's already at like, what is it, 7, 8x premium to NAV?
Mm-hmm.
Something like that, last time I saw.
Something small, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I mean, well, no, that's not small, right? If you're 7x your NAV.
Yes, but it's that, it's a very large premium to NAV, but its market cap is only $50 million. And so
right.
It doesn't have that much juice to fire into buying Sol.
Fair enough, yeah. So... yeah, but that's the thing. Canadian capital markets versus US capital markets, very different, right? So US is just so freaking big that if you can target US retail and get them to say like, oh, I can finally buy out of my 401k some Solana or some Doge or whatever. I think that thing would go crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. The price has moved in the last like 2 weeks or so since they are buying Solana. So I think people are making that speculative bet. Let's go into the FOMC. We had an FOMC meeting, which the recap says central bank is in no hurry to cut rates again. So the Fed is keeping the interest rate target currently to where it is at 4.25 to 4.5%. It warned that inflation remains somewhat elevated. Analysts agree that the pause in the rate cut signals that the Fed is going to make a more cautious approach. Powell said that there will be a more patient approach to policy adjustments, and they will need signs of clear progress on inflation or weakness in the job market to change their stance. But also during the speech, Jerome Powell also made a comment about Bitcoin, kind of reiterating what the repeal of SAB 121 just says, which is banks are perfectly able to serve crypto customers, and we as the Fed are like totally fine with that. Haseeb, do you follow FOMC meetings at all? Like, what's your take here?
I mean, I usually just see what happens afterwards, unless it's a particularly spicy meeting. I think everyone kind of knew what the answer was going to be, which is that Fed's not going to cut. They're going to take a kind of conservative stance of like, hey, we'll wait and see. So I think this FOMC meeting, kind of a nothing burger.
Exactly. Yeah. Par for the course. All right. Coming up next, the crypto executive order that Trump just signed. What is in it? Because it's more than just a national stockpile of crypto, although that was the main headline. The Czech Republic will vote on adding Bitcoin to their central bank reserves, and a different central bank holds $500 million of exposure to not Bitcoin, but MicroStrategy. Everyone place your bets as to what central bank you think that is, and we're going to get to all of this and more. But first, I want to talk about some of these fantastic sponsors that make the show possible, especially Uniswap. It's a browser wallet. It's a mobile wallet. It's a place where I trade my tokens. It's one of the best places to trade in DeFi. Check them out. We're going to go hear from them right now. Are you ready to swap smarter? Uniswap apps are simple, secure, and seamless tools that crypto users trust. The Uniswap protocol has processed more than $2.5 trillion in all-time swap volume, proving it's the go-to liquidity hub for swaps. With support for growing numbers of chains, including Ethereum, Mainnet, Base, Arbitrum, Polygon, ZK Sync, Uniswap apps are built for a multi-chain world. Uniswap syncs your transactions across its web interface, mobile apps, and Chrome browser extensions, so you're never tied to one device. And with self-custody for your funds and MEV protection, Uniswap keeps your crypto secure while you swap anywhere, anytime. Connect your wallet and swap smarter today with the Uniswap web app or download the Uniswap wallet, available now in iOS, Android, and Chrome. Uniswap, the simple, secure way to swap in a multi-chain world. Zello is transitioning from a mobile-first, EVM-compatible Layer 1 blockchain to a high-performance Ethereum Layer 2, built on OP stack with EigenDA and one-block finality. All happening soon with a hard fork. With over 600 million total transactions, 12 million weekly transactions, and 750,000 daily active users, Zello's meteoric rise would place it among one of the top Layer 2s, built for the real world and optimized for fast, low-cost global payments. As the home of the stablecoins, Zello hosts 13 native stablecoins across 7 different currencies, including native USDT on Opera MiniPay, and with over 4 million users in Africa alone. In November, stablecoin volumes hit $6.8 billion, made for seamless on-chain FX trading. Plus, users can pay gas with ERC-20 tokens like USDT and USDC and send crypto to phone numbers in seconds. But why should you care about Zello's transition to a Layer 2? Layer 2s unify Ethereum. L1s fragment it. By becoming a Layer 2, Zello leads the way for other EVM-compatible Layer 1s to follow. Follow Zello on X and witness the great Zello happening, where Zello cuts its inflation in half as it enters its Layer 2 era and continuing its environmental leadership. Trump signed the executive order strengthening American leadership in digital financial technology. This happened last week. And we also have crypto and AI czar David Sacks, who is just standing over Trump's shoulder, telling Trump exactly what he's about to sign. Trump, you can...
I've had that experience.
Yeah. And Trump says, "This is going to make the crypto go. This is going to make the crypto go up, right?" And David Sacks goes, "Absolutely, under your leadership, sir." And I thought that was just hilarious. Okay, so what is
that's amazing.
The executive order. Okay, so the first one is it establishes a working group. Will design a federal regulatory framework for digital assets, including stablecoins, to provide clarity and support for innovation in that sector. And it also mandates an evaluation of the feasibility of creating a national digital asset stockpile. It is not mandated to create a strategic reserve of crypto. It mandates the evaluation of the feasibility of creating a national digital asset stockpile. So a couple steps removed. But there's also a good number of other things that are in this executive order. I think I just want to kind of read them out. I just read the first one. The second one, protecting and promoting the ability of individual citizens and private sector entities alike to access and use for lawful purposes open public blockchains without persecution, including the ability to develop and deploy software to participate in mining and validating, to transact with other persons without unlawful censorship, and to maintain self-custody of digital assets. Pretty much encompassing thumbs up to everything we do in crypto. The next one, promoting the sovereignty of the United States dollar, including through the development of dollar-backed stablecoins worldwide. Next, promoting fair and open access to banking services for all law-abiding individual citizens and private sector entities. And last, prohibiting the establishment, issuance, circulation, and use of a central bank digital currency within the jurisdiction of the United States. Pretty much an overwhelming plus one to everything the crypto industry wants, stands for, believes in, and definitely a direct refutation of choke point 2.0. Haseeb, what's your take?
I would actually take the other side of this. I think this executive order was kind of underwhelming. Everybody, you saw markets kind of dipped a little bit after the signing of the executive order, in large part because one, markets are really anticipating executive order when we didn't get one right when Trump did his first flurry of executive orders. Crypto markets tanked a little bit because they were like, wait, what about us? I thought we had all these day one things you're supposed to do. And then the executive order itself, if you read the executive order, right, all it says is that, okay, I'm creating a committee.
Right.
And here are the things that I want the committee to focus on. Is focus on, you know, no CBDCs, none of this, none of that. So the CBDC thing I think is kind of bullshit because it's a little bit of a, nobody has been trying to do a CBDC anyway. Biden was like, don't do a CBDC. Nobody wants to do a CBDC. This is not a, wow, thank you, Trump, for saving us from all the evil CBDC creators. And so then, okay, like they want them to investigate the concept of a, you know, crypto stockpile.
Right.
We're just like, okay, so we still don't know. So we have nothing. They're just going to sit together in a room and there's going to be a council and the end. So the answer is wait longer. So what you saw with Polymarket was that the likelihood of there actually being a strategic Bitcoin reserve or a crypto reserve or whatever in the first 100 days plummeted to, I think it was like 14% after this executive order got signed. Basically meaning like kick the can down the road. That's what this executive order means. So there's nothing specific here. There's nothing that he hasn't already said on the campaign trail. It's basically, here's a committee. And it's kind of also what Biden did, right? Biden was like, oh, I'm going to hear by executive order, I'll create a committee and that committee is going to talk about stuff and never do anything. So
are you saying like the creation of a committee is kind of a way to just like defer and be like, look, I did something. Yeah, I created a committee.
Yeah,
he hasn't done anything.
This is the definition of not doing anything. So it is an acknowledgement that like something will eventually happen. I'm not ready to do anything yet. Committees will meet and they will talk and TBD. So that's where we're at. So, I mean, to be clear, it's not a repudiation of his campaign promise.
Right.
It's a kick the can down the road, which is fine, but that's what it is.
Would you agree with the idea that it is the weakest possible form of Trump being able to say that I've kept my promises?
Yeah. I think that's a good way to describe it, right? But it's definitely not what markets were looking for.
Right.
Markets are looking for something more concrete.
Right.
Now, I think we're likely to see that more from the SEC, from CFTC, from Treasury, right? They're more equipped to actually make rules and change the way that crypto is affirmatively regulated or treated, or same thing happening from the IRS, but it doesn't look like we're getting it from an executive order. So that's kind of, I think, why markets are a little disappointed, because Trump could do that by executive order and he seemingly hasn't.
On in the European side of things, Czech central bank meeting on Thursday to vote, that's today at the time of recording, to vote on allocating up to 5% of its reserves to Bitcoin. This is an article in the Financial Times, which David Bailey screenshotted because it's behind a paywall. And so the Czech central bank wasn't expecting the Czech central bank to be looking to add 5% of its reserves to Bitcoin. 5% is quite a lot. And on the other side of things, Norway's central bank has revealed that it owns $500 million of MicroStrategy, not Bitcoin, but MicroStrategy. Interesting choice. And so I think this has led to people back on the United States, like Senator Cynthia Lummis, who's retweeting the central bank of the Czech Republic news. If you're not first, you're last. America must make a decisive action to establish a strategic Bitcoin reserve and secure its place in the 21st century. CZ even tweeted out, imagine being the last government to buy on this news. Do you think that we as the United States need to engage in the Bitcoin musical chair central bank game? Like, what's your position on this?
My position is a little complicated. So obviously it's good for my bags, you know,
right,
to have Bitcoin exposure. So I would love to see lots of Bitcoin demand coming from wherever. You know, it doesn't really matter where it's from. The reality is, like, this is not the vibe right now in DC. The vibe in DC is not let's spend more money. The vibe in DC is let's spend less money. Going and buying Bitcoin on the balance sheet, as opposed to what most people think the Bitcoin reserve is going to be, which is just a moratorium on selling the Bitcoin that the government already seizes in criminal seizures, which, to be clear, the executive branch can do without Congress intervention. You don't need a bill. You don't need anything else. Trump could sign a thing tomorrow, an executive order that just says we're going to do that. But actually going out and affirmatively buying Bitcoin, like what the Czech central bank is proposing, that's insane for the U.S. to do. There's no way it's going to happen. Like, absolutely no way.
Right.
There's not the will for it in Congress.
And Congress controls the purse anyways.
Congress controls the purse.
Donald Trump does not control the purse.
If you want to do new spending, that has to come from Congress. Trump cannot just do that on his own. Right. He can stop things from happening, like stop these auctions that normally the Department of Justice does when it seizes, stolen Bitcoin or like Silk Road Bitcoin or whatever. But he can't go and just be like, yo, let's diversify the government into some Bitcoin.
I think, Hasib, that's a very rational response. I think that makes a ton of sense.
Yeah. Look, at the end of the day, like, it's also a question of what do you think the Fed is supposed to be doing? So this would be like the Fed going and taking some of the gold on its balance sheet and putting it into Bitcoin.
I don't think the Fed wants to do that. It just has a vibe.
To be clear, I don't think the Fed wants to do that. I think Congress could tell the Fed to do that. It's usually not what the Fed, what Congress is supposed to be doing is like, basically, you know, essentially like backseat driving the Fed and telling it how to manage its reserves. Normally, we don't assume Congress knows what the hell the Fed should be doing because it's Congress and the Fed is independent. But in principle, yeah, that could, I guess, probably the Congress could decide, hey, new law, Fed has to have 5% reserves in Bitcoin. I think it would be kind of a bad precedent, I think, for Congress to be doing that and just saying like, hey, we're going to decide what should be in reserves because we're bullish on this asset or something.
Right.
look, I'm bullish on Bitcoin. That doesn't necessarily mean that I think everybody, every entity in the world should be, you know, kind of going and deciding to buy my bags. I think it will, it does eventually make sense, but the reality is like Bitcoin is a super volatile asset.
Right.
The other thing, I think Lynn Alden pointed this out in an interview earlier this week, is that I don't think it really matters that much. Mm. Like the US dollar is not what the US dollar is because of what the Fed holds on its balance sheet. Mm. Like, it just doesn't really matter what the Fed holds on its balance sheet. Like, people buy US government debt not because of what our central banks hold in reserves. That's true for most other central banks in the world. People want to buy our debt because we're the US.
Right.
Because of our enormous military might and our tax base and all the, you know, our incredible economy. I honestly don't think markets would care that much if we bought some Bitcoin or we didn't buy some Bitcoin. People would be like, wow, we need to do this for the strength of the American Republic. It's like, that's not really true.
Okay, good takes. I like those takes. Let's turn to Hester Peirce and the SEC. Hester Peirce tweeted out on the January 23rd, which was last Thursday night. So this did not make it into last week's roll-up. She says on Twitter, bye-bye, SAB 121. It's not been fun. And then links to an SEC link of Staff Accounting Bulletin number 122. Basically, repealing SAB 121, rescinding SAB 121, which was the accounting rule that forced banks to treat Bitcoin and other crypto assets as a liability on their balance sheet, meaning that if they wanted to custody Bitcoin, they would have to custody $100,000 of Bitcoin, they would need an additional $100,000 of just liability in order to backstop that, making it terribly capitally inefficient to even serve that as a product. That is gone now. That is gone. SAB 121. We tried to repeal this last in the last congressional year. Gained bipartisan support. Biden vetoed it at the last minute. But what does this mean for crypto? Banks can now custody crypto. They have the green light to custody crypto. And I haven't heard of any new banks just immediately opening their doors to this because this is now repealed, but it's only been 7 days. Haseeb, what was your reaction when you saw this news?
I mean, it's just such a breath of fresh air that like everybody wanted this. This was one of the most obvious Gensler overreaches. Was like, why would you make this rule? This is the craziest rule anyone's ever heard of, is that in order to custody assets, you have to have offsetting equity. Mm-hmm. No other asset is treated this way. Yeah. If you're custodying paintings, if you're custodying, you know, firearms, like whatever, normally you custody something, all you have to do is hold the asset. That's it. That's what custody is. But they're like, no. Custody of crypto is so dangerous that you need not just 100 Bitcoin, you need 100 Bitcoin worth of dollars also on behalf of that customer. I'm like, what? Uh-huh. Do you know what custody is? Why would that make any sense? Like, it's just pure middle finger to the crypto industry. Mm-hmm. And it was almost like, you know, it was the only thing that was bipartisan, even under the Biden administration, that, yeah, this is crazy. This is crazy. The only person who supported this was Elizabeth Warren. Both Democrats and Republicans were like, okay, I don't know about the rest of crypto, but like, this one is insane.
Ridiculous, right? So
just having this, you know, there's still a lot of work to do of like, okay, what does a actual SEC look like in a sane administration? But this thing was just like, okay, time to turn the page. I think that's what this represented more than anything.
How do you think this rolls out? Will I in my Wells Fargo account, will I be able to see like a Bitcoin balance? How do you think this rolls out into?
No. I don't think they want to be custodying Bitcoin or crypto for retail investors. I think this is more of an institutional custody thing. Like, you know, for them to hold crypto for retail, like they have to get comfortable with a lot of other stuff. Like they just have to have their own infrastructure and stuff like that. So I think this is more affecting like State Street. If you remember a long time ago, State Street's one of the biggest asset custodians in the world. They wanted to launch a crypto custody product, and basically SAB 121 dropped, and they were just like, oh shit, like this literally makes it impossible for us to do this in any kind of business efficient way. Maybe it does eventually open the door for banks to do this for consumers, but I think for most of them, they were just using third parties, right? So they would have, Coinbase is holding them on your behalf, and Coinbase is not a bank, and so therefore it's not subject to SAB 121.
Right. Last thing in politics section, Scott Bessent was sworn in as the Treasury Secretary. This was known, this was accounted for, this is not a surprise. It is a pro-crypto appointee. He had a long career at the Soros Fund Management, including a partner and chief investment officer of Soros Fund Management. So he knows how to manage funds. And he's definitely pro-crypto. He has said crypto is about freedom and the crypto economy is here to stay. This is, like I said, one of the many pro-crypto appointees to the Trump cabinet position. Any takes on the appointee here?
Very pro. I mean, Treasury is one of the most important roles. Obviously, Treasury oversees FinCEN, which is, you know, one of the most active overseers of illicit activity in financial markets. So how the stance the Treasury takes is really important to what happens to us in crypto, especially when it comes to regulation and enforcement. But just generally, Bessent's a really brilliant guy. Everything I've ever heard about him has been super positive. So it's a big difference between somebody like Yellen, who's kind of pure career bureaucrat, versus somebody like Bessent, who's much more aggressive, comes from the private sector, has financial experience. And I think if you look at the cast of characters that Trump has put into some of these agencies, it's really bimodal. There are some who are, you know, incredibly effective, like really competent people who everybody's like, yeah, this person's a gangster. And then there's a bunch of clowns. And it's kind of like a toss-up of what you get for each agency. You know, so you got the Cash Patels and then you got Scott Bessent. So for Treasury, it's like, okay, thank God we got somebody who's like really competent and like a good communicator and smart. And then some other agencies, though, you have some crazy people and, you know, look, you just got to call it what it is. But glad to see the Treasury is well accounted
for. It's one of the competent ones.
One of the competent ones, because it's a really important role.
Well, Haseeb, I know you were just dying to know and about the next steps for Gary Gensler. And I know bankless listeners are just trying to figure out what Gary Gensler's next steps. He will return to MIT to teach. So headline here, former SEC chair Gary Gensler named professor of the practice at the MIT Sloan School of Management, where Gary Gensler will join both the Global Economics and Management Group and the Finance Group with a focus on artificial intelligence, finance, financial technology, public policy back at MIT. So I'd like to think, Haseeb, if you can't do, you teach. And Gary Gensler is now returning to his role as a professor at MIT.
I mean, what's really interesting is that I have never seen a public servant who's normally a relatively unsexy office, which is, you know, the SEC, become so widely reviled by young people everywhere in the world. Like compared to when he was originally a professor at MIT, because he was a professor before he ended up becoming SEC chair. And, you know, before that, he was CFTC. He was, I believe, he was CFTC chair in a previous administration. And CFTC is, again, generally pretty unsexy. Like, it's not the kind of thing that's going to get you in the press all the time. As SEC chair, one of the most hated people of any public office I've ever
seen.
Honestly
impressive.
And now, like, he, I don't think he knows what he's in for. Going back and teaching undergrads
or MBAs.
He's going to teach kids. Like, kids hate this guy. It's, like, incredible. There's so many memes about him. So I'm just so curious of what his lived experience of being on campus is going to be when everybody out there who's like under the age of 40 thinks this guy is just an absolute clown. So
there's going to be at least one kid who is in his class at MIT who is also on crypto Twitter in the future.
Oh, there's going to be so many.
I want to bring one of those kids on as a guest. If they go through a semester of Gary Gensler's class, I would like to talk to that kid.
Oh, man. I mean, the finance MBA group at MIT, all those guys are slinging meme coins in their afternoons, like, I guarantee you.
All right, Haseeb, we're going to get into some crypto native launches this week. Venice AI launched and made a big splash. Abstract, the Abstract chain, launched with their mainnet focus on creators. And then Trump Media launched Truth.fi, as well as some of the meme coins. I got a Haseeb Trump meme coin take that I want to get your take about here live since I got it in the tweet form. So we're going to get to all of that and more. But first, I'm going to talk about some of these fantastic sponsors that make this show possible. So we're going to go hear from Frax and the Frax stablecoin. It's got some of the best yields in DeFi. It's like if Circle, Athena, MakerDAO all had a baby. And then you can put it on the Fraxel layer too. Let's go hear from Frax right now. With over $1.5 billion in TVL, the METH protocol is home to METH, the fourth largest ETH liquid staking token, offering one of the highest APRs among the top 10 LSTs. And now, CMETH takes things even further. This restaked version captures multiple yields across Kerak, Eigenlayer, Symbiotic, and many more, making CMETH the most efficient and most composable LRT solution on the market. Metamorphosis Season 1 dropped $7.7 million in Cook rewards to METH holders. Season 2 is currently ongoing, allowing users to earn staking, restaking, and AVS yields, plus rewards in Cook, METH Protocol's governance token, and more. Don't miss out on the opportunity to stake, restake, and shape the future of METH Protocol with Cook. Participate today at meth.mantle.xyz. The Arbitrum Portal is your one-stop hub to entering the Ethereum ecosystem. With over 800 apps, Arbitrum offers something for everyone. Dive into the epicenter of DeFi, where advanced trading, lending, and staking platforms are redefining how we interact with money. Explore Arbitrum's rapidly growing gaming hub, from immersed role-playing games, fast-paced fantasy MMOs, to casual luck battle mobile games. Move assets effortlessly between chains and access the ecosystem with ease via Arbitrum's expansive network of bridges and on-ramps. Step into Arbitrum's flourishing NFT and creator space, where artists, collectors, and social converge, and support your favorite streamers all on-chain. Find new and trending apps and learn how to earn rewards across the Arbitrum ecosystem with limited time campaigns from your favorite projects. Empower your future with Arbitrum. Visit portal.arbitrum.io to find out what's next on your Web3 journey. What if the future of Web3 gaming wasn't just a fantasy, but something you could explore today? Ronin, the blockchain already trusted by millions of players and creators, is opening its doors to a new era of innovation starting February 12th. For players and investors, Ronin is a home to a thriving ecosystem of games, NFTs, and live projects like Axie and Pixels. With its permissionless expansion, the platform is about to unleash new opportunities in gaming, DeFi, AI agents, and more. Sign up for the Ronin wallet now to join 17 million others exploring the ecosystem. And for developers, Ronin is use your platform to build, grow, and scale. With fast transactions, low fees, and proven infrastructure, it's optimized for creativity at scale. Start building on the testnet today and prepare to launch your ideas, whether it's games, meme coins, or an entirely new Web3 experience. Ronin's millions of active users and wallets means tapping into a thriving ecosystem of 3 million monthly active addresses ready to explore your creations. Sign up for Ronin Wallet at wallet.roninchain.com and explore the possibilities. Whether you're a player, investor, or builder, the future of Web3 starts on Ronin. One of the big splashes last week was the token drop from Venice. Venice is Eric Voorhees' project. I kind of think of it as like DuckDuckGo, but for LLMs. It's like a private search, except now using LLM. So it's just like Eric Voorhees' older project, Shapeshift, but before it had user sign up, you could just use the product without doing KYC. Eric Voorhees loves to not collect user information. So he made Venice, which is a kind of a ChatGPT competitor alternative that does not collect your user information. And they launched their VVV token, the Venice token, on a Base, airdropped to over 250,000 wallets. The criteria for receiving the token was kind of interesting. If you own some of the AI tokens on Base, like AIXBT, Virtuals Token, Arrow, DGen, or also you were just a Venice user, you got some of the Venice token. Upon launch, the token price soared up to $2 billion fully diluted, maybe about $300 or $400 million. And then it fell down a little bit, you know, some volatility on launch. But then the Coinbase Assets Twitter account announced that the token was trading live on Coinbase, which I think raised an eyebrow in the community as to how that token got listed on Coinbase so fast, inside of 12 hours, especially in contrast to some longer term Base projects like Virtuals, the one that has spawned AIXBT, which the VVV token was airdropped to and has been a token on Base for well over a year now. And this was also a pretty fat airdrop. Users and airdrop people got tens to $20,000 just from holding some tokens on Base. So congrats to the Venice team. But then also, what do you think about kind of the drama or the controversy or just really this news event as a whole?
A couple thoughts. So one, I think obviously, there was a lot of drama around that time about, okay, why isn't Coinbase supporting the Base ecosystem, which really is coded for just why aren't they listing Virtuals? My guess is that it's probably a securities law thing, is that Virtuals just looks too much like unregistered security stuff of like, okay, AIXBT, it's got a developer. There's like, you know, only a few things that are actually on there that are trading meaningful volume. And this thing, you know, Virtuals recently announced they're doing like a buyback and burn type thing or something like that,
yeah,
where they're doing like some real actual, you know, revenue from the underlying trading interface. That,
right.
Like, so all this stuff, I think, you know, to be clear, I think Virtuals is probably doing the right thing for themselves as a startup. But Coinbase, you know, there's no rules yet. Like, just remember, yeah, okay, there's been a new administration, but right, no rules, no rulemaking. And they're bound by their guidance that they've received from the SEC. Unless the SEC changes their course or changes their communication, they're not allowed to say, like, well, Trump is okay with it. So, you know, right, I kind of know that it's cool. So my guess is that they're never going to say that in public, but that's probably what's going on,
right,
of why they're not supporting Virtuals. Now for Venice itself, look, I love Eric. I think Eric is a G and I'm very interested in what's going on in this whole space. But I'm not a big fan of the storytelling here around Venice. Like, the reality is that Venice, I think, is a little bit trust me, bro. I think it was
You're talking about the claims that it's a private LLM.
Yeah. So I think it was who was it? The other Eric. What's it? Eric Wall. It was Eric Wall, I think, who came out kind of criticizing some of the claims that Venice was making publicly. Because Venice, if you just look at their documentation, basically what they say is like, look, we run these models on our own. They say they get the compute from decentralized sources. They don't really say what they are. There's no proof that they're getting from decentralized sources. Could just be them themselves getting GPUs on the cloud. We don't know. And then they say we use SSL, which, to be clear, everybody on the internet uses SSL. That's not unique. And then they say, we don't retain the data. Mm. And it's okay. How do I know you don't retain the data? There's no like, oh, we use Intel SGX. We use trusted hardware. We have some kind of private computation. We have MPC. There are a lot of answers you could give that would be satisfying to a crypto user of, you're definitely not storing my data. They don't have any such thing. They just basically say, we don't store your data, I promise. Which, to be clear, is fine, right? That's like a DuckDuckGo kind of thing. DuckDuckGo just tells you, look, we don't store your data, I promise. And that's good enough. But to my mind, like, okay, if you're dropping a token and you're like painting this as a crypto project, what's the crypto element? Like, as far as I can see, this is just literally like DuckDuckGo for AI, you know, serving AI models. So I think he's heard that feedback, and I think there's probably some roadmap there that he's probably yet to announce as he's ingesting a lot of this stuff. But I think that's a lot of the reason why after the initial airdrop, you saw this growing degree of skepticism about, is this really the big story about decentralized AI and private inference? Like, I don't think there's actually that much on the technology side yet to be able to prove that out in a way that is beyond just, hey, you can't trust DeepSeek, but you can trust me.
Yeah. And I do think the skeptical muscle of the crypto community is very, very strong. We know how to be very, very skeptical. So I think that's fair. So like kicking the tires of things. Abstract mainnet is now live. This is a pretty anticipated layer two from the Ethereum ecosystem. This is a ZK sync. It's a ZK layer two that uses Celestia for DA, offers native account abstraction. And it really is just hyper-focused on abstracting everything that makes a blockchain and just tries to make it as usable as possible. I don't have too much here. It's just brand new. So now people are going on to Abstract and playing around and kicking the tires. Any quick takes about Abstract?
Thumbs up. More consumer crypto is always good.
Cool. Abstract is also a part of just kind of an extension of the Pudgy's ecosystem. We did a podcast with Luca Netz where we briefly touched on Abstract and the philosophy there. Also out of the Pudgy's ecosystem is a partnership with Pez. That's right. The Pez candy dispenser. And so the Pudgy Penguins Twitter account tweeted out, we're excited to bring Pengu to life with one of the largest candy brands in the world and join the Pez lineup alongside Pokemon, Disney, and others. Really trying to flex the meme of Penguin's weight alongside, you know, Disney, saying, look, it's Disney, it's Pokemon, and then it's also the Penguins. Do you have a penguin, Haseeb? How do you like the Penguins?
I do not have the Penguins. I don't have any.
Did you NFT fumble the penguins at the depths of the bear market in 2023? Because I definitely did.
I fumble everything in crypto. I only do long-term successes, short-term fumbles.
Also launched this week, Symbiotic, which was the basically the big EigenLayer competitor. It's been developing and it's been testnet. The mainnet is now live on Ethereum. They tweeted out, after 2 years of development, 5 independent audits and code competitions were first to launch a feature complete shared security protocol with slashing. The restaking meta, I feel like is in the rear view mirror. I think that was a very big part of the first half of 2024. Now people don't really talk about it too much. Overall, what's your take on either Symbiotic or the state of restaking right now?
Yeah, it definitely feels like there's something of a lull. I think there's not as much interest in financial engineering of staking and restaking and all that kind of stuff. There was a lot of excitement, but I think the market is waiting for receipts. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, you know, show me where all the demand is for AVSs. Show me where all the demand is for shared security. I do think that it there's a good chance that it does materialize, but it's one of these things that it was kind of overhyped. Yeah. And that always scares me as an investor when I see there's too high expectations. Almost always there's going to be a come down, and markets don't like come downs. Right. And I feel like that's kind of what happened with EigenLayer and to some degree with Symbiotic, is that there was just too many people who thought things were already ready. And it just takes time. I don't think there's a reason to be bearish on any of these concepts. It just means that, like, hey, it takes time to build an ecosystem, it takes time to make shit work. That's been true for every ecosystem that we've seen really successful, is that you got to mature. You got to earn your stripes.
I do think one of the reasons why it got so hyped back then is because there was just nothing else to do. Like in 2024, we had the Bitcoin ETFs, and then we just kind of rotated around like infrastructure metas and restaking. Just it was a net new primitive. It is a real thing. But then everyone else was just like bored looking for things to do. And I was like, all right, I guess we'll just turn a mania into.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. The meme coin meta really started in like November of 23.
Yeah.
So it wasn't true that people had nothing to do. People had plenty to do. It was, I think.
Not everyone likes meme coins, though.
That's true. But okay, well, if people had nothing to do, what are they doing now? Who don't like meme coins?
AI. Well, now we get to
that's a decent explanation then. I could buy that.
All right. Speaking of meme coins, this is a tweet that I got on your wall. You said this was a tweet about the Trump and Melania meme coins. And when these things were released, they were touted as just a mass onboarding event. Hundreds of thousands of new wallets. The stats from MoonPay, which is where people without crypto assets
Moonshot,
with it, that was where people would go get the Trump meme coin if they didn't already have like a Solana wallet, or they didn't even know what a wallet was because you could buy it with a debit card, right? And so Moonshot users just exploded. Solana activity also exploded. But then 10 days later after the launch of the Trump meme coin, we're able to look at some of that data. This is you retweeting Rob Haddock from, I believe, chain. No, this is, oh, this is a Dragonfly guy.
He's your partner.
Yeah, yeah. And this was looking at the Chainalysis report about the Trump token, and you tweeted out, disappointing data here. Seems like less than 1% of the users who came in through Moonshot to buy Trump or Melania are doing anything else on chain. If this was the Olympics, the tourists are not doing anything else in the city before they leave. Basically 1% GDP retention. Just elaborate a little bit more here about just your takes and reflections about the Trump meme coin launch.
Yeah, so honestly, this was kind of what I expected. I was surprised to hear a lot of other people saying like, oh, this is a great mass onboarding event. This is going to bring a lot of people in. I remember having a debate on another podcast where we were talking about, you know, whether or not this was really going to be a good first impression for people into crypto. And I think it was Robert Leshner who was saying, you know, everybody gets into crypto through one speculative moment. Maybe it was the ICO bubble for you. Maybe it was DeFi summer for you. But for everybody, there's like some speculative thing that gets you in the front door. And everyone starts that way, and then eventually you find your way into the broader world and you start doing other things, and like that's how everyone starts.
You just need to get your foot in the door.
Yeah, exactly. And so this is no different than any of those. This is also this kind of, you know, onboarding event. And my feeling was that no, this really feels different, right? Mm. This feels like, one, it's not about crypto. It's about this dude, you know, like Trump kind of made it about him and not about crypto or a technology. Like very clearly Moonshot itself abstracts the technology away from you and is like, no, you can't, you don't want to touch Solana. You don't want to touch private keys. You don't want to touch any of that stuff. Here, use a debit card and we'll charge 1% fees for you to do all your trading and never have to leave the app, right? That's basically Moonshot. Now, what people told me, this is the counter argument that I heard that I didn't believe at the time. I thought this is crazy, is that no, some percent of people will take their keys out or they'll transfer to like a phantom wallet or something and they'll go explore the on-chain economy. You know, these are like the people who come for the Olympics and they travel through the streets of Paris and they go to the boulangeries and they're like, you know, why not? You know, they'll just see what's around. Basically, a rounding error of people did any of that. Now, it's only been a week. And so, you know, some people are like, well, you know, maybe it's too early. You got to give it time. I think the right way to understand is that no, this is a funnel. And if people aren't converting in a week, they're never going to convert. Mm. Like these people, most of them lost money. And maybe this is part of the story, is that if they made money, maybe they would have stuck around and be like, oh, what else can I DJ about?
Oh, I can make money here. I'll make money there.
Yeah, exactly. And so if you think about DeFi summer, I think this is the best counter argument. They're like, well, if the Trump coin had gone up, then it would have been a good onboarding event. But it went down, so it's a bad onboarding event, the end. But I think this, I think it's just the irrational optimism about this thing. I think that net-net, the Trump token is going to end up burning more people than it ends up onboarding into crypto. And that burning, it takes a lot of work to undo that damage. That's my take on the Trump token, and I've been pretty public saying that I think it's been a bad thing for crypto writ large. And I think we haven't paid the real cost yet. So okay, it went up, it went down, but the Trump team hasn't unlocked yet. They unlock in 3 months.
Right.
In those 3 months, then they're going to start selling a lot of this token. They own 80% of the supply.
Right.
And we know what happens when a dev owns 80% of the supply and they sell and sell and sell and sell. It's just absolute carnage.
Right.
And I think that's what's going to happen. And the people who are going to be held holding the bag are not crypto natives. The crypto natives, they all understand FTV. They all understand these supply charts. They all look at the bubble charts. They all, like, they understand all this stuff. They're the ones reading Twitter all day and seeing like, oh my God, look on chain. The guy, you know, the devs are selling. It's the normal people who came in through Moonshot.
Who just think it's funny, like, yeah, I'll buy the Trump meme coin. Yeah.
Exactly. I love my president. I want to support him. Yeah. You know, of course, I'm probably in good hands.
Right.
You know, it's those people who are going to end up getting hurt.
Right. And I was talking to some of my non-crypto friends who all saw the Trump meme coin news. And I think they naively anticipated like, oh, everyone in crypto thinks this is great. And then when they asked me about it, they're like, David, you know that this is a terrible look, right? Like, this is a bad look. And so I think universally, people outside of the Trump meme coin circles are like, that looks bad. That's a bad look for crypto.
Totally.
And even internally, people are like, this is a bad look for crypto. Now, previously, meme coins have been touted by like many in the Solana community or just the meme coin trader community that meme coins are the retail onboarding mechanism. This is the culture coins will, you know, take crypto mainstream because they're just so relatable and accessible. How do you think that this relates to that take? Is this now that this is here?
So
do we think that
has been validated? Let's be really clear. The Trump token is not a meme coin. Mm. It's a celeb coin.
Mm.
We've had celeb coins, right? You remember Mother? You remember like all these other like we know what celeb coins are. Celeb coins are, there's one person who's responsible for keeping this token up. They own a huge portion of the supply, And there's not a meme. Like, what's the meme?
Right.
Trump is not a meme. It's his fucking name. He's got his face on it.
He is right? kind of this a meme, is, though. He himself.
No. This is not the meme of Trump. This is the man.
Actually,
this
okay,
is
the man. Right.
He
you're
owns,
right.
like, MAGA. Remember MAGA token?
MAGA
or
token.
Or Trump yeah. token? Like, the previous yeah. Trump token? Those were meme tokens.
Right.
Those were actually memes.
Because they weren't people, made by him. Right.
They weren't made by him. He didn't own it. It was just people being like, oh, isn't it funny? If like, we're going to make a MAGA token, it'll go up and down instead of the prediction mark. That was funny. People talked about it. It was like community owned. And there was no single person who was going to win or lose, right? It's like a big right. Ouija board and we all control right. it together. That to me is a game. It's a game that we all understand what we're playing, right?
Uh-huh.
What Trump is doing with Trump token, that's not a game. That's him making the rules of the game. It's him saying, you know what? Put your money in this piggy bank and underneath it is an open bottom and his hand. That's what Trump token is. Okay.
Right.
That's totally different from a meme coin. I have no problem with meme coins. I think they're basically zero sum and they're just a game. If you want to play that game, totally. It's a better game than a lot of other games out there. But what Trump is doing with Trump token is a totally different ball game. And I think it's in a way fatuous and gives away the entire game to allow him to tell us, yes, a thing that you own 80% of the supply of, is a meme coin.
Yeah,
that's not a meme coin. That's a celeb coin with your name on it.
I do really like the delineation between a celeb coin and a meme coin. I think that's kind of an aha moment for me. I really like that. Because, I've just previously, any single person who has the influence over a price always kind of gives me the heebie-jeebies. And that is not what meme coins are. Meme coins are, like you said, like everyone has their fingers on the Ouija board. I really like that metaphor. But Haseeb, what about the possibility that you can use the meme coin to buy Trump watches and sneakers? Does that change your position at all?
I was worried I might not be able to buy watches and sneakers with my Trump token. No, it changes nothing. I mean, this is like the celeb coin playbook, right? Is
yeah.
it, okay, tokens started going down. I now have to give it some semblance of value,
uh-huh.
you know? So I think the same thing that Iggy Azalea did with Mother
yes,
is that
exactly.
she was like, oh, I'm going to create an MVNO, which, okay, who, what? So I'm going to get an MVNO and you can pay your bill for this MVNO using my meme coin. Okay, now mm-hmm. it's like, okay, you can buy watches and sneakers from my online store using my meme coin. Okay, fine. I could also sell your meme coin for money and use it to buy the watches and sneakers. That's
right.
not the problem.
Right, right.
To me, this is obviously a distraction from like right. what the main thing is about this meme coin is that he owns 80% of it
right.
and he's going to dump it in 3 months, right?
Right?
Or start dumping in 3 months.
Totally.
Yeah. So
let's look on
anyway,
a.
I've said enough. I'll stop ranting.
Yeah,
but
totally.
That's,
but
that's,
okay,
that's
one last Trump watch thing, and this is actually going to be
good.
The last thing of the episode is the World Liberty Financial. Continues to just dollar cost average into a bunch of ETH. And so this is just Jesse Eckel tweeting out transaction after transaction, some like 12 hours ago, 3 days ago, 5 days ago, a week ago, of 4.7, 5.2, $4.9 million clips of ETH just going from Cow Protocol, actually of all places, into the World Liberty Financial DeFi app. I think everyone loves to say like this is Trump buying ETH. It's not actually Trump buying ETH. But then I also don't know who is behind World Liberty Financial and where this money is coming from. Overall, just what's your take about the activity, the on-chain activity of World Liberty Financial?
Yeah. I mean, so for one, I think, very clear, we do know who the world, like go to the website. It'll
we
show
know
you
the team,
the
yes,
Financial
but we don't
team.
Know
yeah.
their customers. We don't know where their, because my understanding is they have customers who give them money and then they go invest it on-chain. That's my understanding of how this thing works.
No. The product's not live. So they did a crowd sale.
Uh-huh.
The crowd sale was doing very badly before Trump got elected. Trump got elected. Justin Sun gave them like $60 million or something, some very large sum of money. And then all of a sudden, the entire, I think $200 million raise was filled, which I have heard kind of a rumor. I've heard that a lot of this was Saudi money that came in and basically was like, oh, here's a way that we can, you know, maybe buy access or something.
Right.
I don't know, total rumor. So I don't know if any of that's substantiated, but the idea that suddenly a clip of 100 plus million showed up very, very late in the game after Trump launched his meme coin and after the election. So like even after the election, this thing was basically dead. There was like, you know, 10% right. of the crowd sale that was filled. Now they're taking that money and using it to buy crypto assets, which is great. Like you said, it's not Trump. It's obviously Trump affiliated. We know that Barron is very closely involved. So this is like Barron's pet project or something. And I guess Donald Trump Jr. is also involved. So it's like a Trump family thing.
Right.
Trump, I think
Trump himself
it.
Is on the governance board over.
He's an advisor.
He's an advisor. Yes.
Supposedly. Yes. Although normally as president, you're supposed to divest from all your financial interests.
Right.
Doesn't seem like he's
Trump
doing that.
Trump is just making more financial exactly. interest, not less.
Exactly. So like, you know, launching a meme coin 2 days before you're inaugurated is a pretty gangster move relative to what most presidents are doing 2 days before they're inaugurated. So in no way is this an ordinary process of what we expect from a president. And I think this is par for the course. So, you know, obviously, right, we're playing this game of like, oh, what asset is World Liberty Financial going to buy? But it's not Trump. It's, you know, three steps removed from Trump in terms of the actual decision making. Like, these guys are crypto natives.
Yeah. 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 See, my man, it's been a pleasure having you on the weekly roll up. I couldn't do it without you. I need a buddy to go through the news with me, and you've really been helpful here. I believe you might have already done this is the second podcast of the day for you. Maybe you're doing Chopping Block tomorrow. But if listeners are not familiar with Chopping Block, tell them about it, and where can they go hear more of you if they just like the sound of your voice?
So every week, me, my partner Tom Schmidt, and then Tarun Chitra and Robert Leshner from formerly Compound / Robot Ventures, we do a podcast together every week, kind of like this, where we just talk about the news and what's going on in the world. So you can find it on the Unchained podcast, run by Laura Shin. We do it once a week, and I mean, we're a bunch of VCs, so we have a very different perspective on the market than most of the people who are more trading oriented. But if you're into that, that's what we talk about.
Yeah, it's one of the few podcasts I have that I do not skip on a weekly basis. So thank you for that. I always appreciate other people making crypto content out there, because I think more crypto content needs to be out there. And so tip of the hat to you, sir. We'll get all of those links
right
in the
back
show
at
notes.
You, man.
Yeah, cheers. Just any last thoughts about just like, you know, we're in the last day, almost the last day of January in crypto. What are you looking forward to in 2025 in crypto land? What are you paying attention to? What's Dragonfly investing in? Just open-ended question here.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think there's been a lot of malaise in this market. Obviously, we've been whipsawing a lot from, okay, is Trump going to do this? Is, you know, Trump token, what's going on, da da da. I do suspect that the rest of the year is going to be a little more calm. I'm always a little hesitant to say that because this month has been absolutely, it's just insane. But I do think like, okay, now all eyes are going to be on what do the agencies do? Is there going to be any specific rulemaking? And when do we get a strategic Bitcoin reserve? Almost certainly it's not going to happen soon now that we've had this executive order of, you know, hey, committees are going to figure this out later. So I think things are going to be a little more calm, which I think is good because the market could use some calm. And the reality is that in most crypto markets, bull cycles and bear cycles, like all the stuff that we see that's set up for crypto is really, really good. Everything is super bullish, right? Like things really could not be better from a regulatory perspective, from a demand perspective, from a vibes perspective. Macro is looking pretty solid. And so I think what all this should tell you is that be patient. Like not everything's going to happen quickly. Just because Trump got elected doesn't mean that, okay, hey, everything's going to go to the moon all of a sudden and everything should be ecstatic. So I think on some level that impatience often finds its way into crazy assets, crazy narratives, you know, things going up and down really rapidly. As a VC, having been through many, many cycles and having invested through the long and short of things, number one advice that I give to entrepreneurs and also give to just anybody who's in this world is be patient. You know, more things can happen in a couple of years than you think and fewer things can change in a month than you think. So I'd say chill. I think it's going to be a good year, but it's going to take its time.
Wise wisdom from a guy who knows a thing or two about investing in crypto. Haseeb, thanks so much, my man.
Thanks for having me.
Bankless Nation, you guys know the deal. Crypto is risky. You can lose what you put in, but we are headed west. This is the frontier. It's not for everyone, but we are glad you are with us on the Bankless journey. Thanks a lot.